be blue, 'cause I can't see you. Richie, I love you.
Hello, this is Richie Wexler from Vintage Annals Archive Outsider Podcast. I am very excited to have a very special guest, Eric Edelstein. I'm going to warn you, this is going to be a long intro. I'll try to keep it to five or six, hopefully less, but this is going to be what I call my Marc Maron intro. I love Marc Maron. What the fuck with Marc Maron? I love the podcast. It's definitely highly influential to our podcast, although we have a different theme and it's a little bit different. We're kind of getting more into storytelling, but it's coming from there. And I'll be honest, I usually skip those because I don't like them, but honestly, being a podcaster, I've gone back and listened to a lot, and there's a lot of great stuff in there. All right, to be honest, you know, I've been very lucky in doing the podcast, and it's a bigger project too, but just for now, we'll talk about the podcast. I've gotten some really, you know, really, really well-known people, really famous people. I don't care about fame on its own. They just happen to be people I really had a ton of respect for. I got very lucky. But I'm not in this world. I don't come from Hollywood. I don't have a background in like podcasting or interviewing. I just kind of fell into it. And you know, it's been tough. Like I love doing this. You know, I've been lucky. I relate to the actor strike because I was in a job, and a field for almost 30 years that just did nothing but, you know, make money off of me and treat me like shit for the most part. And my last situation, I just had to leave, but because of that, I got about 6 months of money to be able to go back to the podcast and just work for myself. And that was a dream. And at times, because I didn't really want to go back, but I'm like, I got one shot. I got to take it. And, you know, it's hard. I mean, it's hard. There's a lot of rejection. I do happen to talk to a lot of actors, and I relate to them in a way that it's hard to like put yourself out there, and you get it's not easy. You get more rejections than you get acceptance. So it's not always been easy to make connections. We make more connections again through the Instagram page. I've gotten lucky. We have a really nice following, and most people who've done the podcast are fans of the page, and that's been my main like bread and butter, so to speak. I reached out to Eric Edelstein maybe a year ago to bring him into a project on a show he was in. I'm not going to name the show. It sounds like Jinx, because I'm still confused in the strike, and I'm just trying to keep everybody safe and myself. And, you know, through a long, we went back and forth, and finally we figured it out. And, you know, I'll be honest, he really went out of his way to, you know, I was a stranger to him, to just treat him, you know, it was very, very generous to do to a stranger. And that really, you know, really made me just really, really like Eric a lot. We put him in the category as Jews. We call them a mensch, which is defined as a person of integrity and honor. I've always liked Eric as an actor. I identify in different ways, but I generally identify as being an empath of sorts that's been coming out. And I could always tell there's an honesty to him. He's very real, very open person, very authentic. It comes out in his performances, it comes out in when you meet him as a person. I've seen a lot of his work. I've been a big fan. It's well worth digging into his IMDb and catching up on his work if you haven't seen a lot of him. The second part of really what impressed me about Eric was his patience. So once I'm dyslexic, you know, my attention span can be tricky. The original structure of the podcast was more, the idea was to more conversation. I'd do a lot of research and then improvise from there. And I'm really trying to get the stories. And I kind of overloaded on the research, which making me kind of a shitty listener because I felt like I had to get to certain things. And I didn't ever, you know, I wound up cutting people off, not on purpose, but, you know, I thought that's what I had to do because I had to get to the next thing. And I've been trying to get back to that. I've been trying to, you know, I've been aware of that for the last few months. I'm really working on not researching as much, keeping it simple, and just really trying to listen. And I can tell you in Eric's interview, that was one of the ones that really, he was very, you know, I think I cut him off once or twice, how to listen. And we just had very open communication. And that wound up being, I feel like, one of the best interviews I've ever done because I just let go and we took the conversation where it went and, you know, it was great. I mean, I really feel like I connected with Eric in a way I feel like we had a really, really real talk and I'm very proud of this. This is I've done a lot of these things and I love everybody I get to talk to, but this one just feels a little more special, which actually why we went a little longer. I feel like there was so much good there that I generally try to keep it to an hour, but we did 90 minutes because I just felt like there was so much great stuff in there. And again, he just really taught me how to listen. I can really listen well, and I can really talk, but when I have to go back and forth from between the two, it gets thrown. And I do insert myself, but it's more about connecting. It's more about, like, a therapist might share a story to get you to open up. It's never to, like, then take it and go with it. But, you know, at times, it's tricky. I mean, I'll be honest, when it comes to, like, dyslexia or ADD, when I'm tired, it gets, like, five times worse. And that was a tricky day because it was the day before the strike. I all of a sudden had one, I think I had one interview planned or maybe two, and then all of a sudden I had four because everybody had to do it before the next day because they weren't allowed to anymore. And he was my last interview after like literally hours and hours of four interviews. Anyway, it was great. And it's funny, I didn't, usually I would have researched more the next day because I had a whole open day to work with him. To do research before the episode, and you know, we just kind of went in blind, so it was great. And I gotta say, like, because you know, really learning to listen to an episode, it was great because Eric is a really good storyteller and he's got great stories. I mean, we get into like Neil Young, Twin Peaks, and the most special part I think is he just talks about his grandfather for a while, and I feel like that's the key to me. Like, when I can get someone to just talk about their grandfather and they share that with me, it's very special. I'm a photographer, and when someone gives you, you know, a lot of their person, you know, gives you like their personality in a photo, it's very special. In the same way, when somebody shares about someone that's special to them, it really feels like you got very lucky. And what did I do to deserve this sharing? So enjoy this episode. Getting the stories like that is why I do this. This episode reminds me of the one we did with our third episode with Stephen Tobolowsky. And check that one out after. I'm just going to give a little intro to Eric. Eric is character actor, most known for playing Grizz on the hit Cartoon Network Wee Bear Bears, and for dying painfully in the movies Jurassic World and Green Room. He's recurred on Parks and Rec, Fresh Off the Boat, Shameless, Drunk History, guested on shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm, Modern Family, and Love. You can see him now as Daddy Shark on Nickelodeon's Baby Shark Big Show and King Shark on Teen Titans, and as Jeff on Disney's The Ghost and Molly McGee. And also, he played Willie on the show that rhymes with Jinx. Enjoy is a special. Please check out Eric's shit. Add him on Instagram. I'm really excited what happens when he gets older and the more he does. He's just gonna, you know, he's gonna be one of those character actors that is just gonna be one of those people you see all over the place. And he's like that now, but I can tell he's just gonna keep getting better and better and just keep doing more interesting work. So thanks again. Enjoy.
Friend, how are you?
Let's start with this is kind of a boring question, but I'm just curious on your path to acting.
I love it, and the cool thing about this story is it heavily involves Doug Renetti, the star Minx, in a wonderful way. So I started out doing theater as a child in Vancouver, Washington, and then I started getting more theater work, and then I started going into Portland, Oregon to do plays professionally. Vancouver, Washington is a suburb of Portland.
I want to know how old you are just so I can envision this and what year you're talking about.
I think I did my first play at like 12 or 13 years old. I did like Narnia and Inherit the Wind and Hans Christian Andersen.
How old are you?
I'm a 46-year-old man.
I'm 52. We're in the same world. Okay, so
yeah,
now
I read at a 49-year-old reading level, so I've got that going for me. Yeah, so I started doing plays in Portland and loved it, and then I got offered but the plays were at like the Portland Civic Auditorium, and I was having to miss school, and that was weird. And then the kids all get bussed into these plays. And they're not, high school kids are not particularly cool if they're having to leave school and go see somebody that's missing school in a play. And so I'd go back and people would be weird. And then I got this professional offer, and it was a television show to teach Japanese kids English. I've always been sensitive about, so then I looked at this thing, and I was going to be having a full-time job and missing more school, and I was going to be playing like an overweight basketball player who every time he ate, his buttons shot off like weapons. And I went to my parents, and it was real money. And like they put, you know, a bunch of my money in a college fund, and I could spend like 10% of baseball cards. I'm just like, I don't want to do this. I
10%.
I don't want to do this. Like, you don't want to do this part. I'm like, I don't want to act. Kids are weird at school. I don't enjoy it. It feels like a job. I'd rather be playing baseball and basketball. And bless my parents' heart, they immediately like, yeah, then don't do it. Don't, we're fine. Don't do
it. It's funny because I feel like you hear the opposite story a lot, where parents wanted their kids to do it and force them into it. But yeah, you don't hear a lot about kids being like, I don't, this is, you know.
Well, bless their hearts, because when I came back to it, I really wanted to. And that was when, hilariously. So then after that, I just lived a normal childhood. I went to Gonzaga in Spokane. And very hilariously, if you know Gonzaga now, it'd probably be only because they have a very great basketball team. And part of that is they blew up and got good my junior year at Gonzaga. And I was the play-by-play announcer. And they actually did not have a television deal. So if you wanted to watch this great basketball team, you had to watch me on GUTV, which had previously the only people that watch would be...
Was that like public access?
Yeah, it was like the student day. So kids that were too blacked out to get to the game, or my great aunt Lillian Edelstein in her Jewish nursing home in Spokane.
Oh my God.
And that was our, and then the second season they blew up and people were watching. I remember the athletic director being like, people are watching. You have to, all my roommates were on the team, so they could do no wrong. I was not objective. I gave them nicknames. And then one of the guys on the team tore his ACL, and he and I started doing a comedy act together. And then we started touring around, and we won a Best in the Northwest comedy. And I did stand up as this character who is a on strike steel worker. And I would just do the comedians in front of me, their material, worse, like an egotistical guy who thought he could do their material better. And it worked. Only if I had people ahead of me did this work. I would do their jokes poorly, but there was some magic to it because the crowd knew this was real in that moment, and crowds love that. The other comedians just hated me. And then I remember we had a Best in Northwest comedy competition where we drew straws, and they all just looked at me like, if you draw one or two, your act, you have no act. Luckily, I drew later on. We won Best in the Northwest. My parents were there, and then they gave me their blessing to move to Los Angeles and act.
I want to go back to comedy. I'm curious who the comedians were, either the big guys or the you know, the folks you came up with. Who were the comedians that really influenced you or meant a lot to you?
Yeah, I mean, you say the big guys, and it's that, because everything in my life changed after I saw Chris Farley.
Chris Farley.
Because I was not that cool in school. And then all of a sudden, Chris Farley, Matt Foley came out, and I could do a perfect one.
No, how do you feel about doing that right now?
Nope. Well, in a van down by the river. And yeah, but you know, it's what high school kids do. And then amazingly, and I took that through college. So that was how I really got in with the basketball team, is they had these basketball camps with, you know, 1500 kids in the arena. And I would come out and do Matt Foley, the Croc Hunter, Bill Walton, and the kids would love it. And it kind of gave me wings even more to want to move down to LA and do this. And so they wanted to entertain the kids besides a dunk contest. And my roommates on the team didn't really want to dunk that much. So like, will you please go as long as you can? And it was this amazing experience having these kids, you know, it was like a rock show. And it really gave me wings. And if I hadn't gone to Spokane and Gonzaga, I have no idea where I'd be right now. But it wouldn't be living my dream like I am.
And it's funny, I had a teen, I'm a musical theater kid, and I had a teen theater company because I wanted to give that back to kids. Because I feel like, you know, I think about sports, right? Well, what is sports for theater kids? Theater. And so they always cut theater, but I'm like, well, why are they not, you know, why is sports always okay, but theater isn't? That's here nor there.
No, I love it though. And that reminds me, I mean, I did my first improv class when I was 12, and I was just like ripping off Dana Carvey's impressions and doing a George Bush. And like, I was a weird kid into politics and comedy. I would rush home and watch Comedy Central, and I would watch like stand up and all those guys that I just thought were amazing. And then it would be that, and then Kids in the Hall. And then I have a funny story for later about, I did Getting Dug with High with Dave Foley about a year and a half ago.
I have this block, and I'm curious to discuss it with you for a second. I don't know what it is about Monty Python. I don't get it. Never did. But everything I love, all the best shit, comes from Mr. Show, Kids in the Hall. Everything I love comes from Monty Python, but that on its own, I can't handle. What's your relationship with that? And what do you think that is? I'm just curious on like, Were you close to Monty Python?
I wish, and to this day, I wish I loved it more.
Yeah.
But I think it was probably, you know, sometimes the first originators aren't the ones that hit our heart as much, but they start everything in motion. And it was also so for that time, for the 70s. But I'm grateful to it. And then also with Monty Python, what I love is that Elvis was a huge Monty Python fan and had them memorized. He would have people over to watch a Monty Python movie. Elvis, the king. He would have people over to watch a Monty Python movie and turn the volume down and act out the entire movie.
Holy shit.
Yeah, there's some amazing Elvis stories. You can see me talk about him on Drunk History, talking about him getting his federal narcotics badge.
He was also what's called a Shabbat goy, which is not a great term. He would be hired by the Orthodox Jews to turn their lights on and off.
Elvis Presley? That's right. And he found out near the end of his life that he was part Jewish. So if you see his mother's gravestone, there's a Star of David on there. And then he also very carefully, he wore one around his neck, and they asked, like, you have a cross and a Star of David? And he's like, I'm not getting out of heaven on a technicality, man. My bases are covered. So yeah, I love that Elvis loved Monty Python. But yeah, there's a lot of those originators sometimes. And like, you know, Carlin, now when I watch him, I get him to a degree I didn't as a kid. When you're a kid, you're like, oh yeah, this is like my friend's dad. But like, you don't understand that this guy is breaking down how the world is, and also very prophetic.
Yeah.
When you watch a George Carlin bit now, or Bill Hicks, you're just kind of like, oh man, these were our prophets. These are our philosopher kings. And I wish there was a little more of that now in the comedy world.
I want to tie in this idea of truth and comedy, because I feel like those guys really imbibe. But also, like, one of my favorite teachers or comedian, you know, improv folks is fucking Del Close, because he trained all the crazies. And Chris Farley, like, something, he was so insane. I don't know. I think everybody he taught, like, most of them died from an overdose, or a good amount of them. There's a certain craziness and freedom in his teaching.
Yeah. And I moved down here with the book Truth and Comedy. I remember getting that and having it blow my mind. I guess I love Attack the Stage and how Del taught, but you are right. A lot of people he taught did not have the self-care. I would have perhaps loved if they're mirror some other qualities. Because I think when you're in your 20s, you know, it's the Neil Young, better to burn out than to fade away. Now I'm much more a fan of fading away. I think that's a hell of a lot cooler. And I think the glorifying of drugs and like flaming out and like, you know, I think it's heartbreaking that Chris Farley saw that in John Belushi, and that's what he wanted to emulate. And apparently that's came out last year. That's what Bill Murray really got turned off by, where he's like, hold on, you think that's cool? And I think for me, part of that Del Close thing, that book was invaluable to me. I almost moved to Chicago instead of Los Angeles when I was 23 to study at Second City. And I wonder what would have happened if I had, but I came to Second City, Los Angeles. But I think the real win in life is to be able to keep your funny while taking care of yourself and figuring your stuff out. And so if I'm less funny at a party, and that was for me as a kid, people asked me to do impressions, I would do them. You asked me to do Matt Foley there. That's the first time I've done that in 10 years because I'm thrilled to for this, because we're telling a story, but I mean, it's not being on all the time. If there's a lesson from Chris Farley, it's to turn it off and to keep your walls up and to take care of yourself and send yourself love. And especially for him, deal with your addiction. And also for me, as somebody who went to Catholic school, you know, I deeply understand where he was coming from with it. And he fought like a mother. He was going to St. Monica's Catholic Church every day. And part of me wishes he would have found, you know, what he was looking for there. But he worked so hard. Like, I did a movie with Tom Arnold, who was a hero for him and a sponsor. And I think that the real victory for a lot of us that thought it was cool back then to be the crazy big guy and fall and be nuts. Like for me now, I love people like, boy, for a comedian, you're not very funny. And I'm like, yeah, I think around my friends, I'm okay, but I don't need to dance for you, pal. And I think that's kind of the victory in that. And that's a long way of saying I loved Del Close when I was 23, but as you say, a lot of his proteges, yeah. So like the embracing of like boundaries and being healthy and like turning it off sometimes at a party. But I mean, Farley was just my ultimate hero. Then later on, I just got super into the big guys because, as they say, representation matters. And you see people that look like you on TV. I'd be in high school and be like, "Guy, you look like Dan Connor." And then, you know, I watched Big Lebowski in college and it blew my mind. I'm like, "Oh my gosh, John Goodman's the guy." You know, he was immediately like, "Oh, that's a touchstone." And then, like, last year, I finally got to play my first, like, regular dad part on a pilot. And I'm like, "God, that's finally happening where I can get to kind of play." I've aged into being able to play like those kind of parts that, you know, take some longevity.
Yeah. And I think about this. I think about, like, you know, I watch a lot of documentaries, I watch a lot of biopics. And when it's the same fucking shit, they become big, they do drugs, it goes bad, and then they're fucking broke at the end. Like, I don't want to watch it anymore.
It's heartbreaking, right?
There's a workaholism that can also be, I think about Peter Sellers, who, like, apparently could not distinguish himself from any characters. And I feel like there's people that go, apparently talking about Elvis, the guy who played Elvis was so into Elvis that he couldn't lose the accent for like 3 or 4 months.
Yeah. And Austin Butler, he knocked it out of the park. And like,
tell me what you thought about the movie, just while we're talking about it.
Austin Butler was incredible and deserved every nomination. I thought he kind of shapeshifted. And I thought that the beginning of the movie, where they kind of show that Elvis is this amazing, uniquely American bouillabaisse of gospel and country and rhythm and blues,
yeah,
and sneaking into black churches, I just thought they really nailed that part of it. And the kid they got to play real young Elvis was amazing. And there's just so much with Elvis left to tell. My issue is the estate freezes everything with Elvis around 1972.
Okay.
And for me, goddamn it, the most interesting stuff with Elvis, even musically, is late Elvis. I'm interested in late Elvis. If you're going to be really cliche here, I think Elvis is America. We are perhaps getting near our heading off to the toilet phase, but playing a hell of a rendition of Unchained Melody before we do. But that's cliche and easy. But I think late Elvis, even musically, listen to an Elvis song called Almost in Love. King's heart's broken. Priscilla left him for her fucking karate teacher. And he's sitting there one night, you know, he's had a couple of something, and he's almost in love. When you listen to that album, it blows your mind. And also the Elvis stories of late Elvis are so hilarious.
Can you throw one out there that I don't know?
Yeah, just first off, watch Drunk History on Elvis I did.
And you're part of
Bob Odenkirk and Jack Black. That's a fun one.
Holy fuck. I mean, I can't even imagine what it's like to be in a room with those two guys
I'll tell you a quick great story. Bob is the nicest, kindest human being. I wouldn't be sitting here now if it weren't for Bob.
Nice. Tell me about that.
He gave me wings and belief when nobody did. So I met him years ago through our buddy Derek Waters, that went on to do Drunk History. And then we did a show together called Derek and Simon. And at the same time, I was starting doing a two-man comedy show with Jake Johnson. And Bob brought, through Derek, Jake and I in. So there were like four buddies. It was a show called Derek and Simon. And then he had, like, you know, Jake, me, and a guy named Eric Filipkowski. And we were the buddies, and we'd pitch Bob stories. And he was so nice. And then there's this great episode, you can find it, called The Regimen. And Bob said that they were backstage and they did like a Mr. Show meet and greet. And he's like, "God, Eric, some girl came up and started telling us how we needed to drink our own piss, that it was real good for you." And I thought, "God, you know who's nice enough to do that is Eric." So the whole bit was I was dating a girl who wanted me to drink my own piss for longevity. And then the other hilarious story was, this was like 12 years ago, and I brought back a tiny puppy from Puerto Rico. And we were training the puppy, which means you take it out every 15 minutes. And hilariously, my girlfriend, now wife, lived 20 feet from where Bob Odenkirk's wife, Naomi, opened her office. And they just bought this house for an office and they're doing construction. And one day it was like 6:15. I was taking my dog out. Construction was so loud, so early in the morning. Bob sees me. He's like, "Eric, God, what are you doing here? I thought you lived." I'm like, "Oh, we're training this dog, so I can't be in my apartment. So we're just," he's like, but aren't you here in the construction?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, it's okay. But it's waking you up." I'm like, "Bob, it doesn't matter. He knows I idolize him." He's like, "God, but are you hearing it?" I'm like, "Well, you know, Bob, there's not much empathy in construction." And he just goes, "God, ah, you want a couch?" And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "God, we got this couch. It's got a little bit of cat urine on, but it'll come right out. It's a really good couch, Eric." I'm like, "Bob, we have a Goodwill couch in there. And my girlfriend's, I'd be a hero if I brought home a couch."
Yeah.
And he's like, "Okay, let me ask Naomi. Then later on the day, my buddy Steve Berg and I went over and moved this couch out of Bob Odenkirk's house. And he was so happy he made this situation right because he felt so awful that we were being woken up. And that's why when people are usually like, Hollywood, oh, who's a jerk, who's not? I'm like, man, I've only had one or two people that were not cool, and they weren't people I looked up to. They were surprising people. And like Bob Odenkirk, so wonderful. Then a couple years later, I was having one of those really down moments in Hollywood where I felt like I was never going to work again. And this is when he was kind of having a down moment. Like, I remember I went to a premiere he did for a prison movie, and the premiere was like, yeah, and it was, the premiere was at a small movie theater in Westwood, and everybody had to pay for their ticket. And he just looked so sad. And then after that, he wrote this pilot for NBC, and he wrote me as a series regular. He's like, you know, Eric, the kind of guy who will, you can, who will help you move and be happy to do it. And I wanted to be like, man, I hated helping people move, Bob, and I'm glad you see the best in me. But I'm like, holy shit, Bob Odenkirk, who I used to watch on the Larry Sanders Show with my grandfather, and Stevie Grant, Larry's agent. I'm like, oh, this guy believes in me? And it's one of those, but I've had a million of those. And I'm only here because these people I work with that really gave me belief in myself when I did not have it.
Well, I'm just curious on some people that you have like really tried to bring up that you admire.
I mean, so many of them I meet, like I do animation, and when I meet young animators, they just give me faith in the future of like, okay, God, can we just hang on till the kids come along? But it's also like, you know, you're so right. So many people treated me like that, where you do want to turn that around. So when I see somebody that some people might view as like a rival or something, I'm like, well, no, let's just be friends and play brothers. Yeah. Like it's not that hard. And there's, you know, so many, you know, younger people coming up that I look up to. I mean, I would say the young person we met doing that Derek and Simon show that immediately you just realized was punching at a higher level than any of us was Michael Cera, where he was immediately, I'm like, hold on, this kid's how old? Because there's a 70-year-old man in this body. And it just instantly being, and then we did a day of improv with him at this bar in Koreatown where he played an asshole bartender. And I remember just, you know, sitting in awe of him. And then, you know, that, you know, Michael's easy to, but there, I remember I did a show called Clarence, and the creator of it had a mental health issue and then was acting out and got fired. And I remember thinking like, oh my God, I'm losing this job, because he also does the voice. And then this guy, Spencer Rothbell, who was the head of story and did a couple extra voices, came in and saved the show because he did the Clarence voice and kept us in employment for like 3 or 4 more years. So for the rest of my life, I will do whatever I can to help Spencer Rothbell. Not like that he needs it. He's such a great human being and one of those animation people that I'm in awe of all the time. There's another one called Katie Crown, who played my wife on that show. She's a brilliant Canadian writer that now writes for Bob's Burgers. And that was kind of my experience in animation, was just always being overwhelmed by people's talents.
I'm curious on, were you an animation fan? Like, I don't know if you, I grew up at a time when, like, to see the weird animation, you went to that Spike and Mike's festival. Is that your world? Did you grow up with, like, as a fan of animation, even as a kid?
Simpsons VHSs until they were unwatchable. Over and over and oh yeah, there it is. Oh, I love it. Yeah, that was for me it, and that was like this other weird world. And then I remember another person moving down here that was absolutely incredible to me was Sam Simon. And he was another one. If you remember Sam Simon, yeah, he was the original EP that came in, I believe, from Tracy Ullman, and created kind of the world. And he did another one of these, you know, there's all these shows that almost went, didn't go. He wrote this show about this kind of loser with heart that was, you know, working as a day laborer, and he picked me to play the guy. And the show didn't go forward, but I remember being like, man, I've watched every Simpsons VHS. I saw this man's name on so many episodes, and this guy believes in me. And it's just another one of those kind of magic things that gives you wings.
Coming back to basketball, were you in, I thought I saw you were in Hoops. Were you in Hoops?
Yeah.
How was that? I love that fucking show.
Yeah, I played Kirk, his buddy. Yeah, and I, you know, that's just another one where whatever I thought of moving to Hollywood, and I thought it'd be like an extended business trip, and I was sure the people would not be as amazing as the ones I just was leaving in Spokane. I met the most loyal group of friends in my life down here that have saved me over and over again, that have believed in me. And that one was my buddy Ben Hoffman, who I went through the Second City program with down here, and Jake Johnson, and they created the show together, and they just fought like hell to have me. The studio wanted a bigger name, and like, no, we want Eric. This is what this is all about. We met through Eric. Eric's doing it. And then for The Voice, like, we just want you. I'm like, you sure? And like, we just want you to be yourself. Just be Eric. I'm like, no problem. But I mean, animation is always just the most fun. And as I found myself being kind of limited by my size for years, because, you know, I feel like a theater.
How tall are you?
I'm like 6'5". Like, you know, 270, and I look tougher than I am. Nobody knows there's a little theater kid with Pippin songs in.
Were you a musical theater kid, just some curiosity?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, big time. I went to Bernadette Peters 2 weeks ago. But no, I when I was a kid, I went to Into the Woods when I was 12, and then it was Nancy Dussault. She did great. But it was 2 weeks after Bernadette, so I've had to see Bernadette now since 1989, and it finally happened 2 weeks ago, and she was stunning.
Into the Woods?
Incredible. No, she does a solo show. But Into the Woods is playing at the Amundsen, and the great David Patrick Kelly, who you may know from The Warriors, or I know him as Jerry Horn from Twin Peaks, who damn near stole the whole season 3 of The Return. I think I'm high. So we're going to go, a bunch of us Twin Peaks folks.
You were in the Twin Peaks TV show, but
yes, I'm in the new one.
Tell me about that experience. I'm curious on, are you a fan? Like, what was it like to be in that fucking world?
Yeah, I mean, I'm the biggest fan, and like, I was like the nerdy kid watching every episode of Twin Peaks in Vancouver, Washington on the couch with my mother. So he had a weird, I read a book years ago that said Lorne Michaels has this psychic sense of hiring people that are fans of the show. And there's something with David Lynch where it feels like the same, because he hires, somehow just knows. So hilariously, and this story has now been told, I kind of, you know, I didn't want to tell it. But now that he's told it, I'm good with it. Mike Serra reached out to me. He knew I was like into weird meditation and all kinds of other stuff, and the Self-Realization Fellowship and all this strange stuff that I love. And he's like, I think I'm going to do the intro to TM class at the TM Foundation. You want to go? And I'm like, I'm in. So I did this intro to TM class with Mike and my buddy Simon Helberg and his wife. Oh, he's the absolute best. Ubermensch. Ubermensch, and like, so loyal. And also, I always say a lot of people from this town and this business are the most normal. So like, his dad was a character actor, his mom was in casting, and like, he was doing laundry at my apartment complex 2 weeks before he got Big Bang Theory.
Were you a fan of the Coen Brothers movie he made? I just needed to bring that before I forgot.
Simple Man. I loved it. He's incredible. And that's actually what it's like hanging out with him. He has this kind of almost rabbinical calming presence with him. And I just love, like, you can read his bank account online now, but he's the exact same human.
His imitations I've heard him do are fucking stellar.
Oh, he's one of those guys. And he was doing them all at Second City, and I was just in awe of him. And then I remember Jake and I were doing a 2-person show, and the one that we would do stuff with it seamlessly was Simon, where it's like, oh, are we somehow even, you know, better as a 3? Like, this is amazing. Because Jake and I just had real magic performing together, and Simon would come in and seamlessly bring it. And so Simon, Mike, and I did a TM course at the Transcendental Meditation Center. And then one of the teachers named Pookie came in, and she said, she's this genius TM teacher that grew up in Fairfield, Iowa, where they teach all the kids meditation. And she said, hey, David heard that there were actors doing the program, and he'd love to have you out to his house to meditate with him. And Mike and I just looked at each other and we're like, there's no fucking way. There's no way we're going to be going to about a week.
Wait, David Lynch.
David Lynch.
Holy shit.
Because he just opened his David Lynch Foundation.
Meditation guy, right?
Yes, yes. And he had just opened up his meditation center, and which does amazing work in getting like veterans with PTSD, victims of childhood prostitution, all inmates, all the people that need meditation the most, getting it to them for free. And so we went to his house.
Holy shit.
And we park, and I can't believe it. And then I'm like, I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be back at the Starbucks in Highland and Franklin. But what a cool dream. And then we walk in, and he was just so completely kind and so nice, and just was there for any questions about meditation. I was like, oh, I'm from Spokane. because I knew he lived there, and he's looking at Spokane. Oh, yes, I remember those ponderosa pines and the Air Force planes flying overhead. And so, but I could see him staring at Mike. And so Mike plays a very famous, iconic character in Twin Peaks season 3 called Wally Brando. And I think David Lynch was kind of writing that character in his head as he met Michael. And so hilariously, this is where it gets funny, down the road, maybe a year.
Okay.
I got an audition in my email box for Twin Peaks. And I'm freaking out. I'm assuming it's connected to this meditation thing.
Okay.
So I go into the audition, and you can see all this on disc 7 of Twin Peaks The Return, amazingly, which again doesn't feel real. But you walk into this deep, deep valley industrial building. And then within this industrial building, you walk in a lobby, and there's a bunch of people that look like they just stepped out of a David Lynch movie. And they're all getting in there to go on audition. You don't have any sides to prepare. All it is going to be, you're told, is an on-camera interview. And so I just kind of kept watching these really cool looking people in like three-piece suits and velvet collars. And like, I would watch them go in, and then they'd be a slightly different person than they were in the lobby. And I'm like, shit, man, just be yourself. Just be yourself. Just be yourself. Like, this is Twin Peaks. Just be yourself. But like, how can I be myself? It's Twin Peaks. And then I went in, and Joanna Rae, the most legendary casting director, she's very coy. She's like, hello, Eric. How are you? I'm like, good. She's like, do you know what you're auditioning for? I'm like, Twin Peaks. She's like, and what do you think of that? I'm like, just trying to keep it casual. And I blurted out a giggle. And thank God I did, because you can see it on the DVD. This burrow just burrowed in his head, because he's very musical and he's his own sound editor. And you see him going like this, and he goes, could there be three detectives? And thank God both Mark Frost and Sabrina Sutherland immediately went, yes. He goes, okay, I think I want to hire that big guy with that laugh. And then he started breaking down what my character is while they're cutting to him explaining stuff to me on set. And he's like, all right, he's an ace detective, though he may not look like it. And like, it just was the most magical thing that happened. And then hilariously on the last day, like, we completely hit it off, and he would just give me lines, or he'd be like, okay, can you give me two giggles and kind of suppress the third? And I go, and then one day, like, I had a recurring nightmare of having to memorize a monologue. And then one day I had it, and he was like, don't worry, you can look at the paper. What I care about is that your mother is lost, and you're the only one sweet enough to help her. And it got me over my fear of memorizing. And I also had Don Murray there, who was Oscar nominated in 1956. And like, it was this magic thing set up for me to get over this fear. And it worked.
What I want to ask is, how has meditation or the process of being present affected your acting work?
Wow, that's a great question, because it's essential. And like, there's not a single time I work where I've not done two meditations that day. And I have it down to, if I have a half hour lunch, I will power eat in 8 minutes and then still get my 20 minutes in. And I found, if there's any kind of weird secret society in Hollywood, I mean, if there really is, they're not cluing me in. But the closest thing's probably, I notice after lunch, a lot of great actors have the same calmness I do. And a lot of people are meditating. And I completely recommend his book, Catching the Big Fish, because I also have ADHD. And meditation has been the one thing that has been incredibly beneficial for me, that really helps with my interrupting.
Meditation makes me feel like I'm a trapped animal, and I'm losing my, I don't know what it is, having to be, like, I have ways of I do things that are meditative. Photography is meditation for me. But if it's that, like, still, I don't know what it is. I would love to get to that point.
What kind of meditation did you do?
Different. I don't want to get too much into it, but just, I think to do meditation, you have to have a life that is meditative. And I think in America, it's very fucking hard.
Oh, that's bullshit. That's total fucking bullshit. No, well, I would recommend, and for anyone out there, listen to David Lynch's book, Catching the Big Fish, because that is an amazing one. It's very short. Listen to him read it. But this whole thing, I promise you, I was not a meditator. And like, all you need are 40 minutes a day total. How often are we on our phone? You get your screen time report of how often you're on your phone. I bet you have 40 minutes.
Have you ever gotten into Rick Rubin at all? But he talks about this idea that, like, in the ether is this creativity. And I feel like I've seen this, and I feel like you were talking about this before, but when two people have this energy they're putting out in the ether, I think it connects, and it goes back to the person, and you communicate without even saying a word. And I love that that's how he talks about making art or music, and it's so natural and empathic.
Ah, beautiful. Yeah, it is that way, and there's a calmness and a stillness that comes from meditation. And Rick Rubin is another huge TM guy and another big meditator. And like, you know, what it gives you is a calmness and an acceptance of stillness and quiet. And most often, I think Bill Murray said that the key for me to acting is that I just have to be very comfortable. And meditation does that. And when I look at the level of work, you know, because the goal in this life, as David Lynch called the art life, is just keep getting better. I'm still in class. I want to be light years better 5 years ago than I was now. I can look back at work from 5 years ago, like, noble effort, but I'm going to get better. I look at my work on Minx, I'm like, all right, we're getting better. We're getting better, but we still got a long way to go. And I think there's just something really magical about the that notion.
What do you feel like you are your strength? Or where have you succeeded? Where have you pushed and then learned, if I can ask you?
I mean, I think as a character actor, it's a little bit different because, you know, you're also a supporting actor, which means you're supporting people. That means supporting them on camera and supporting them off camera. And I think for too long, I probably leaned too much support. It is that Second City thing and make your partner look good, which everything I do is built on. But then Jake was the one who also nudged me, like, hey man, you're getting these guest stars and recurring. It's always great acting, but like, grab the fucking ball and dunk it. He's like, when we're on our 90th episode of New Girl, we don't want to do anything. We are praying for some guest actor to come in and just crush it. Just kill it. You know what we call that actor? Tuition. So we can pay for our fucking kids' tuition. And when he said that, it was like kind of being freed. So now I'm like, well, they can always dial me down. But when I came into Minx, and especially with someone like Sam, who I went so far back with, it was like, I knew I had the permission to just kind of go for it and feel free to really take my time and really enjoy it. And in fact, that was kind of what the whole thing demanded.
It was so obvious to me how much chemistry you guys have. And I'm just curious if you're okay talking about your friendship, working together. Like, it seems like you guys are connected. And he said he thought he knew you for 20 years. I don't know if it's true or not, but I could tell that you guys have affinity and that made that believable. So I'm just curious on how you know him, you know, what, if you've worked together, how, you know, how you got to connected. What do you like about Sam? What does Sam bring out in you?
Oh, I love Sam so much. And I mean, I remember the summer before I moved down here, watching Freaks and Geeks over and over and over again. And my roommates in college, I'm like, no, it's on the ABC Family Channel, but this thing is amazing. And then moving down here, and I quickly met Sam and Martin, and it was just crazy to me. But then to kind of circle back to another story, when I moved down here, I was working a bunch of odd jobs. I was working as a bouncer. And then I was living in a place called the Las Palmas Estates, which was a former one-hour motel. And this other guy that lived there named Brian Farrell said to me, you're going to love my roommate. Like, I would see him, he'd be outside smoking. He's like, you're going to love my roommate. And I remember just thinking, I'm probably not going to love his roommate. Probably not going to like his roommate at all. Shit, is this another person I got to avoid? Well, his roommate showed up, and he's this hilarious guy from Chicago, and it's Jake Johnson. And he is there. He had just gotten a job playing poker at a casino. So there's this weird thing where you can't have the house dealing, so they pay people to play poker, and Jake was doing that for like $12 an hour or something, and I was working as a bouncer. But the night one that I met Jake, we had so many things in common to a crazy degree that we started writing a two-person show together, and it was called This Is My Friend. It was a sketch show, and we put it up at Second City, and everyone else that put up a show there, you had to get one of the Second City teachers to direct. And I remember like, well, we could either get this person. He's like, Jake said, why don't we direct it? Meaning, why does Jake direct it? And I'm like, well, I mean, I think you have to. He's like, no, we can direct. I just did this in New York with the Midwesterners. We're great. It's no problem. We got this. So we put up this show, and it out of nowhere, you know, started kind of blowing up, and people started coming. And it was this real weird thing. And it was Jake and I completely at our best. And then from that, we shot our own pilot with Jeremy Connor, who'd go on to do Drunk History and all kinds of other cool stuff. And then we sold that pilot. We entered it into a TV, the Independent Television Festival, and it won. And then we got agents and managers from this thing we shot for $1,000 that we got from Jason Ritter. God bless him. I'll love him forever. Jason Ritter, Simon Helberg, and Jeremy Connor produced this thing.
Nice.
Gave us wings, bought into us, didn't want anything in return and were just amazing in sharing and incredible. And then that was what started Jake and I. Well, we did a This Is My Friend table read for NBC. And we wrote a part of a neighbor that is entertained by us, but also like, you guys are quasi-criminal. And we're like, God, what if in a dream world, what if Sam Levine would do it? And then we wrote it for Sam Levine, and then we like reached out, even though we barely knew him, and then we're just in shock that Sam Levine agreed to do it. So we had this huge NBC table read that we did very well on, and Sam played our neighbor. And it was so bizarre to me, because I just remember like 3 years earlier watching Sam Levine over and over and over again, and then all of a sudden he's in this giant room with me. And then the show didn't go, and then Jake and I are just kind of thrown in the deep end of Hollywood. And then very soon afterward, he got New Girl. But I just always say I just hit the best friend lottery.
I want to segue to Jake for a second in terms of mix. And I want to, you could tell there's a lot of him in that role. And therefore, I'm seeing a lot of authenticity. I might be wrong, but why is that you were on the show? Like, what's going on there?
Well, it's a part of him, and it's more than that. It's a things that he finds hilarious, and what he's always going to do that makes him on another level, and to me makes him a top 10 actor in the world, is he brings a heart to it. On paper, Minx is written so beautifully, but the Doug part's probably one of like, ooh, this is a balancing act. But then Jake Johnson brings in this giant beating heart that you just can't teach. And he's having so much fun with it. And also, he's really great, kind of, I think, being the Papa Bear of that cast. It is the sweetest, nicest cast on television. You don't want to be in your trailer when you're working on Minx. You want to be sitting in there in those folding chairs around those other actors, because sometimes on these shows, because as a character actor, you're always a guest. And you're always the new kid in school. And on some of these show like that, you're only as good as the biggest asshole. And with Minx, there's not one. And I'm probably the biggest asshole or Sam. But like, God bless. But like, it's just like a day at the spa. And Olivia is so lovely. And when you look at Jake on that show, he's just having so much fun. Where, you know, it's the part he's born to play, and it's all the stuff he finds very funny. And when people see him in season two, he takes it to a whole other level.
Jake is the father. My Lennon to me is the heart of the show as well. Is Lennon the mother of that show?
Yeah. And Lennon, Jake would be the first to tell you. I mean, Jake refers to Lennon Parham as Michael Jordan. She's on another level. And I met her years ago on Parks and Rec and was instantly wowed by her. And then, you know, was not a surprise watching her blow up. But to see her now, she, you know, it's like I said, we just keep growing and expanding. And she just is Jordan. She can dunk, she can shoot, she can defend, she can block shots, she can rebound. Lennon Parham is just comedy gold and is also so humble. So nice, so kind, makes time and space for everyone. And I'm, you know, more and more I look at Hollywood and I kind of see the people who really deserve to be rewarded being rewarded. And that's very heartening. And Lennon is right at the top of that list.
All right. I need to hear the penis story from Minx.
Oh, my God. And you got full permission. I'm an asshole. Like, I'm just like, you know, I'm always like proud of being a character. I'm like, thing with other actors is they don't want to look weak. They don't want to blah, blah. Well, this was when it was my turn to just be an asshole and to be weak and not want to look weak. Because I early on decided I did not want to be the big guy with my shirt off in commercials. I don't want to do that shit. I don't want to do nudity. It's not fun. You know, you'd go for these like Bud Light commercials where you'd be the joke and I'm like, I don't want to do this, pass. And so when I heard after I did so I auditioned for another part and didn't get it, the part of Norman.
Who was Norman? Norman was like the guy, the reporter guy?
Yes. And the guy that leads the revolt again at Bottom Line. And so I didn't get that, but that's what I always tell younger actors is all your job is to do in there is to just make a fan. Like I've waited in waiting rooms, waiting to audition where I hear them offering it to three people who look like me, but are more famous. And so I can either say, well, what the hell? They're wasting my, or like, I'm going to go in there and make a fan. And this was one of those, when you look at Norman, he was better for me for that part than I was. He's great. And I can't lament that. But I'm in there and they see something else. And then also, you know, I've got this radio voice from being a journalism major. And so Jake got the script. He's like, dude, there's a radio show host and I think it might be you. I'm like, shut up. He's like, I don't know. I'm going to talk to Ellen. And then he's like, dude, this might be really happening. I'm like, holy shit, man, really? And that's all you want to do in those auditions. If you're not going to get it, make a fan and burrow in their head like my laugh did with David Lynch or like my radio voice did with that. And then all of a sudden it starts unfolding this amazing Willy part. And then that first episode, so you'll also have this thing where, you know, you kind of can feel it happening where, you know, you're on set the first day, things are going well. And then you hopefully see writers starting to think of more to do with you. And then Ben Carlin, who's really just amazing and does such a lion's share of work on Minx, came up. He's like, are you okay having a fake dick? And then I paused. And then my good buddy, Jake Johnson, said, let me answer for him. Yes, he is. And I'm like, oh, God, my poor mother. Oh, I know how this is going to go down. No. So I was totally nervous about it. And then I got a call from Carly about the fake dick. And she's like, oh, and did you hear that it's little and nubby? And I knew how real the dicks looked on Minx. And I couldn't figure out what was real and what was not. So Mr. Oh, it's a character actor's job to be grimy and dirty and look weak and be a nerd. And come on. I then pick up the phone in a rare fit of Hollywood bullshit. And I call Jake Johnson, star of the show, who immediately just starts laughing at me. He's like, well, you know what, E? If you don't want to play the part, I'm sure there's a lot of other people that will. This was going to be another part. And then they're like, well, what if it's Willie? But you know what, bud? If you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. But yeah, a guy like that would probably have a little knobby dick, right? And I'm like, God. And then Carly, bless her heart, was so amazing. And when I showed up and saw it, she could tell this was the most uncomfortable I've been in 22 years of acting down here. Like, dude, you know, you just can't fathom what it's going to be like. And then Allison Tolman, who played my wife that maims me, she and I had just played a sweet married couple in this wonderful movie, the best comedy movie I've done, called Family, where our daughter runs off to the Gathering of the Juggalos with the comedic tour de force from Taylor Schilling. And so, you know, it was so much easier with her there. And then you put on, Carly pulls out the little fake dick and then they give you instructions. And then the only thing I screwed up on was, you know, I watched like a RuPaul Drag Race video for, oh, you Florida folks are right. I totally got groomed, my God. So where you push it under and then I didn't cover it with gauze. So I just had the sticky stuff on my substantial man bush. And then Carly looked scared when I came back in and I'm like, they made it so easy, that set. And the scene was done in like 10 minutes and they didn't make me do much nudity. It's just kind of sitting there through my boxers. Where I'm like, oh, I was so worried I was going to be like naked and my mom would hate it. And I'd be hearing shit. And I'm like, I was in the gifted program. How did I get here? And instead it was the most fun ever. Carly made it so fun. And then now she and Jake and I can laugh about what a weenie I was, no pun intended, maybe, when they wanted to give me that dick.
What I want to ask is, when I talked to Sam, he said his influence for his character was Alex Jones. Did you bring?
I did not know that.
Do you work that way? Did you feel like you modeled that character on anything in particular, or not so much?
Yeah, I thought it was jarring to hear how like Tom Likas would talk about women, and to hear people think it was funny. Like, look, here's the thing with broads. Here's this, and then I was like, you know, your first instinct sometimes playing a piece of crap is to shapeshift and do another voice. But for me, the real cheat code to playing a bad guy, which I do a lot, is to bring yourself to it. So then I realized, yeah, I'm not going to do this thing. I'm not going to do a Likas voice here. There's just no need to do it. I'm going to do Willie as close to myself as I can. I already kind of have this broadcasting voice. And, you know, you just kind of allow the inner weirdo to flourish in a funny way.
I've talked to a lot of different people about this. I talked to Sam about this. It feels like for people that are kind, and I think for people that are kind and get a lot of shit, being crazy, being angry, being mean, being an asshole is fun as fuck. Do you find that for you, that it's kind of cathartic?
Yeah. I mean, you know, where else do you get to yell at somebody? Or, you know, I just don't think they teach actors proper self-care after playing bad guys, because there's, you know, it's just a weird, weird deal. I remember I did this movie Green Room, and afterward I was just completely messed up because I'd played a Nazi for 6 weeks. And the other actors, I come from the comedy world, but all the English actors were very method and didn't want to have lunch with me and stuff for the most part. And I think it made my performance better. I hate to say it, But, you know, it's real hard to deal with. But it's so much fun to be an asshole. It's so much fun to drop it and let it go because you never want to do it in society. It's like Larry David said, the version of him on Curb is the version that he wishes he was. But it's totally fun to, you know, to chew scenery like Willie and Franco get to do. And to talk. Here's the thing with these broads. Like, God, what awful fucking idiots. But it's so perfect and it's so fun to play a villain like that. Like, you know.
Do you ever have to apologize to people once you're done that performance?
Not that I have to, but you know, it's just, it's fun. It's like you kind of let this thing drift inside of you, like a shapeshift almost, and then let it go. So I remember when I was doing Green Room, I would say the most awful fucking things on camera, like homophobic slurs to Anton Yelchin, and he wasn't method. And then they'd yell cut, and he'd kind of look at me, and he'd watch the character leave, and then he'd go, ha ha! And then we'd walk off to craft services and get Skittles together. Because for me, if I were to live with that kind of darkness and yell cut and I'm like, oh, I'm still a skinhead, that's hurting me.
While I got your attention, what about, did you get to deal with Patrick Stewart? Did you get to meet Patrick?
Oh yeah, he played my boss in it. And he's just the coolest dude ever. It's his birthday today. It's his birthday. And the thing, I don't know, did you ever get to see him on Extras? I think you would know because he's so funny.
I'm remembering Ian McKellen in that, and I'm yes. Not sure if I'm confusing the two.
Oh, no, they were both on it. But Patrick Stewart plays this version of himself. And normally when people play versions of themselves, it's like them being an asshole with a wink to the camera. But he was really doing this guy who's written this script where his superpower is women's clothes come off. And he's like, but, you know, of course, by then, I've seen everything. And he was so funny and so kind, and he would just sit in folding chairs with us. And then I just remember my lines with him are through the door. And I'm like, what kind of dream is this where I'm doing lines with fucking Patrick Stewart? And then I just felt like he and Macon Blair and Mark Webber really kind of set the bar for us as Nazis because they brought themselves to it. And that's what we all did. And that's what I think it demands, because you have to bring yourself to these bad guys, because unfortunately there are too many goddamn Nazis now. The area that we were supposed to be shooting at is full of Nazis now. There's parts of Orange County, you rock in the wrong bar. I once walked in the wrong bar in Pomona and people came up to me saying they liked my character in Green Room. Then I looked around, realized where I was, did not need to disclose my last name, and just very fearfully left. And so for me then, in this crazy world with these bad people, it's our duty to try to play those bad parts the best we can. But for me, the best thing is to just leave that character the second they yell cut, go get Skittles as myself. And then when they yell, you know, 30 minutes before they yell action, I'll get in the bad guy mode again.
Have you ever turned down a role because you felt ethically problematic about the character you're going to play?
Yeah. And it's even easier because so many of these indie movies, they don't want to pay you now. But yeah, I mean, I thought I had established enough of a career in comedy that it was known that I was that first. And then you realize you can't kind of unring a bell the first time people saw you. So after I did Green Room, all of these people kind of typecast me. And that was just what was in my inbox too often. And I turned a bunch down, and I'll also say it was nothing heroic because it was also bargain basement directors trying to copy Jeremy Saulnier or trying to copy David Lynch. And I would be like, yeah, this is not worth it for me. Like, and then I would even say, I'm like, well, I'd love to play this lawyer. I'd love to play that. And then, you know, one of those that actually did work out. I'm like, oh, I don't want to play the bad guy. I've got a great person for the bad guy, but I've already done that. So if you're only offering me $600 a day, which means net, I'll get $300 with no residuals. I want to play. Well, that's why we're going on strike. I'm like, I want to play something I've not been able to play before. So that's my guideline. And then at the same time as all of that, I did this We Bear Bears show where I'm just myself, just a sweet grizzly bear. And then I did Drunk History as myself. And then David Lynch, you know, when I first went in for Twin Peaks, I'm like, oh God, am I going to be some horrific killer? And then the first day he's like, now you have to understand one thing. You are a sweetheart. Your brothers are not going to help anyone. You're the only one. You are a sweetheart, but you are also an ace detective. And I just wanted to cry because he kind of cast based on what he sees in people. And I'd seriously gotten fucked up in the head because I kept getting offered bad guy after bad guy after bad guy. And here's my actual childhood hero who's just wants me to play a big sweetie with an awkward giggle.
We're in different places in different worlds, but, you know, this whole podcasting has been a fucking dream. And it came out of an Instagram account.
An incredible Instagram account. Dude, I couldn't believe when you, I already followed you, and then you started posting about it, and I was just kind of in shock. Wow.
Let's get to Neil Young. I want to know why you love Neil Young.
He's just my guy. You know, I grew up into hip hop, and then in college, my sister came to visit and left a Harvest CD behind. But, you know, he's just my favorite, and there's just so much to learn from him, I think, artistically. Where, like, I'm going to see him tonight, and he's going to play Rarities. He's calling it the Hidden by Hits Tour. He's not going to do, he could walk out there and do a 90-minute show where everybody there knows every word to every song. He's not going to do that. He's going to open with a song called I'm the Ocean, which he did with Pearl Jam in 95. For somebody like me, this is the biggest, most incredible song, and I cry every time I hear it. But there's people there that are furious. And the last concert, was like, you know, they booed me? They booed me up there. And he was just in Palos Verdes. And every show, there's drunken idiots, and I'm convinced people are drunker post-COVID. And then there's also this level of entitlement. Certain people where they want this entertainment handed to them on a spoon. I'm like, well, you're at the wrong show, because that's not what Neil Young ever does, ever. How did you start your Instagram? Because my wife also has a very popular Instagram that's changed our life. So how did you start yours?
I've been doing it for 13 years, but what's funny is I didn't know how the fucking shit worked. So for the first year, I would post 100 images a day because I thought it was randomized. Cool. I did it for a long time. I got very lucky one day, and Amy fucking Sedaris, who's the queen of all that shit, reposted my shit. And she wrote, stolen without permission from this person. I am such a guilty fucking Jew that I wrote her an apology. She ever read it? Because I looked and she, I don't think she ever read it. And that within a few days, I had like 4,000 followers.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing.
I love it. I love to sit there and I, you know, even with this Minx thing, like this Minx thing is insane. No normal person would try to do this much for this thing. Like, I added 7 interviews in the last 3 days.
Wow. Well, Minx needs it. It doesn't have a companion podcast.
I got to talk to Rich Sommer today.
Oh, I love Rich. Are you kidding?
Randomly, I'm like, hey, dude, like and you may find this too. I think you and I understand that if you're a good person and you just ask people for shit and you're respectful, you can go really fucking far.
It took me forever to learn that, though. I don't know about you. It took me a long time. It was my wife's good influence of not being afraid to ask, because I didn't want to ask for things forever. And now I'm comfortable doing it more and more each day.
Who were the people... Anybody, family, who were the people that really shaped you as a human being?
My grandfather, more than anyone. He was a guy named John Snyder, and he was the mayor of Medford, Oregon, while selling jokes. So he never left Medford, never went to Hollywood, but we have like stacks of checks from Phyllis Diller. And she like right in the margins, like, John, you think funny. And now, did she probably write that so he wouldn't cash the $15 check? Sure. But he always believed in me, and he raised me on great comedy, and he was real cool. When they started like banning rap records, my parents wouldn't get them for me, and my grandfather was like, all right, I'll buy you this Two Live Crew album, but you have to get one Nourishing record. Just look, you know, whatever it is, just something good. So I'd be like, all right, well, I got Public Enemy, Fear of a Black Planet that has the explicit records thing, but I'm also going to get this Branford Marsalis record. Be like, okay, all right, that's good. So I would just spend summers with him, and he was just my hero, and he was such a brilliant guy, and he really, you know, the main thing for me was belief, where my parents believed in me, my grandparents believed in me, and then, you know, I went to Gonzaga, and my friends there believed in me.
What's Gonzaga?
It's the college I went to in Spokane.
And your program, just to clarify, your program was general theater?
No. I auditioned for one play in high school and didn't get it. And it was probably because I was like a class clown and they didn't think. But no, my major was journalism and broadcast journalism. And then I did a sketch show my senior year and completely got the bug. And that was when I realized I wanted to act and I wanted to do this. So, you know, coming up, for me, my grandfather really kind of put this dream in me as a kid. And then just when I moved down here, all these incredible magical circumstances of Second City, just starting in LA, this group that went earlier than me that had Derek and Simon Helberg and Ben Hoffman and Clint Culp, they brought me in to their fold that gave me a ton of belief, and I was just so darn grateful. And then getting Jake Johnson in my apartment complex changed my life forever, to the point where I'm still sitting here right now talking to you. So I always feel like I'm playing with like house money. Like, I can't believe this worked out. I just feel so darn lucky all the time.
Is there a connection between meditation or being present and gratitude? What is the role gratitude plays in your life?
I mean, everything. And like, you know, any of those personal development books you read, it's all about gratitude is kind of the currency that keeps things happening. But my best days are one where like 10 times a day, I'm like, God, this is so grateful. This is so lucky. And if you ever had health stuff and you feel better later, you have this sense of gratitude. We're like, oh man.
I want to talk about your connection with Doug Benson, because it seems like you've done a lot around with Doug.
Yeah, man, he's out there. He's way out there, but I love Doug. But to circle back, the funny, so I've done all of his podcasts. I've done the Doug Loves Movies with Sam Levine in Christmas, which Sam completely cheated at the end, because you're supposed to name all the movies of a certain actor. So they go, Sam, which actor? You know, I'm going to take Sam Levine. Motherfucker, I can name 25 movies I've done that no one has heard of too. So Sam won Doug Loves Movies, where I thought I finally had a chance to win. But people are fired up that Willie and Franco reunited. There were a lot of cool Minx fans there. God bless them all. But Doug's really cool, and his shows are so fun because you just never know what you're going to encounter. So the first time I did Getting Doug with High, I'm like, God, am I going to get in trouble for this? This is a little weird, and I'm on a kid's show. I'm Grizz from We Bare Bears, and now I'm Daddy Shark, and I'm getting stoned. And then the first time I did, I walk in, there's Tiffany Haddish, and I'm like, oh, okay, I'm fine. So then the second time I went in, I'm like, who's it going to be? Who's it going to be? I walk in, and it's Dave Foley, who I used to get on my bike and trundle home from Ellsworth Elementary to go watch The Kids in the Hall at 3:30 on Comedy Central. And I'm like, dude, I had no idea Dave Foley was a smoker. This is going to be amazing. I also have a whole strategy for getting Doug with High, because he wants the viral moment. Because Jack Black got way too high and had a panic attack.
Oh, shit.
So any person that's on there, and it's the most viewed one. So any person that's on there, they're looking to, you know, Doug wouldn't mind if Dave Foley had a reaction. So I walk in there and I said, I'm like, well, hell yeah, I guess Dave Foley's a occasional smoker. I'm like, hey, hi. And I always go, how are you? And he's like, oh, you're doing this with me? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, oh, you know what? I hate weed. And I'm like, what? And he's like, oh, my wife's making me do this to promote our podcast. I hate weed. And I'm like, well, shit, Dave. I'm like, hold on. Before he comes in here, here's what he's going to try to do. He's going to try to give you sativa. It's going to fuck with your brain. Do not do it. Tell Doug you only want indica. I'm not going to let him give you anything else. And he's like, what do you mean? I'm like, there's two kinds of weed. If you just have indica, it won't really touch your brain. But if you get that sativa, I know why you hate weed, and it's going to take you right there.
Okay.
And we went in, and sure enough, Dave's like, I want the indica. And Doug's like, sure you don't want this? Try this little bubbler, Dave. I'm like, don't do it. I'm like, don't do that to Dave Foley. And so I was able to successfully keep a childhood comedy hero from having a panic attack and going viral. Of which, you know, I'm sure he'll send me a gift basket sometime.
I haven't asked this question to anyone in a long time. I was making a regular question. I think a lot about teachers as mentors and good and bad. And I'm just curious, if you're okay answering, I like to ask people to share one story about a mentor. And again, that could be your grandfather, whoever it is, or teacher, and then one story that's not as good, if you're comfortable with those two stories.
Yeah, let me think.
It was a regular question. I haven't asked this question in like 50, 20
years. No, I love it, King. So I started out down here doing improv, but with no formal theater training or anything else. And then I was doing Second City, and some friends there, Brian Kimmett and Rob Adler, invited me to an improv thing with this guy named David Avcolli, who is the former head of the theater school at DePaul. And he did Spolen Games, which those are the real precursors to what Del Close did. They're children's
like
games.
Like Improv Olympic kind of shit?
They're kids' games.
Kids'
so
games,
she
okay.
Wrote them for kids.
Oh, nice, okay.
With the idea of actors are essentially children, we're at our best when we're just playing. So here are games to just make us play.
It's like Montessori improv.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, if I'm not a kid on set, I've failed.
Yeah.
Like, and if I'm thinking too much, I've failed. And these games, they're called Spolen games. And they're really incredible. And I highly recommend them for any improviser. But I started doing these games. And then I saw him just kind of staring at me. And they walked, he's like, "What the fuck is your story?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'm just down. I'm doing improv with these guys." He's like, "Where'd you come from?" I'm like, "Gonzaga." And he's like, "Gonzaga? Like the basketball team?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I was the basketball announcer there." He's like, "You didn't go to theater school?" I'm like, "No." He's like, "Do not ever take another acting class. They'll ruin you. You stick with me. I will get you where you need to go. Don't ever take another. Trust me, you're sensitive. They'll really screw you up."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Okay." So I just put my faith in him for the next 20 years.
Holy shit.
And he sculpted an actor out of me. He just got me better.
Yeah.
And he would always look at me and he would see me playing these strings of like 5 and under blue collar parts, which are hilarious because my wife is the one that fixes things around this house. And he's like, "They can put you in a fucking plumber outfit forever, Eric. You're just more than that. We're going to get you to be more than that. They can do this. They don't have vision." And he would always say, "Whatever part you are is the focus." So his favorite thing was always saying, like, the guy in, sorry, it's not on the waterfront. What is it? Stella. What's that? We know what it is.
Marlon Brando, right?
Yeah, add it in post. But the end, it's Blanche DuBois gets sent to, you know, the asylum. And there's a doctor that comes in to take her to the asylum.
Okay.
And there's a famous interview he loves saying, it was famous to him, where they asked the guy that played the doctor, "So what's this play that you're in about?" And he said, "It's about a doctor that takes a woman for help." Meaning that tiny part, that three-line doctor part, you have to approach it like that's what the movie is. And so for me, you know, Minx is about a radio show host that gets in a big fight with a disgusting porn publisher. Jurassic World is about a paddock supervisor in over his head who shouldn't be monitoring a dinosaur that's having a bad day of work. You know what I mean? Shameless is about a grocery store owner who has unorthodox requests from his employees but gives them the best shifts.
I feel like you should rewrite your IMDb. If you could somehow go on IMDb and just rewrite these as from that perspective, would be fucking
Yeah, hilarious. But it's kind of amazing, right? And I never heard that before him. And it's not to put yourself first. It's saying, well, everybody's own world is just their world. When I'm coming in with you today, I'm not like, well, what's he been doing? Or what else is my job today is to be a podcast guest with a legend who has an Instagram account that I loved before I ever heard you like Minx. So that's what it's about today. And so, you know, I just did a movie in Portland where I play a teacher trying to help a kid. And it's really funny. And it's called Outdoor School. And it's this amazing movie. And it's, again, it's based on this brilliant writer named Vic Chambry, who won the Moth with a story about how outdoor school in Portland changed his life when he was a kid. And it was all about 90s Portland and the Trailblazers and this whole world I knew and loved. And this incredible director named Ime Ituk, who I worked with on Twin Peaks. And I worked with him again on a pilot I shot in Portland. And I'm like, "Man, I know you're going to be a brilliant director. I'm dying to be in your first movie." Because you can tell those people that are future stars on set that are just have that thing. And David loved him. So, you know, that's kind of what he gave me, that you have to give whatever part you are all the importance in the world. There's no, it's real corny, but there are no small parts. There are no small actors. Like, you are bringing your fully present form to every single line, every single breath you take. And that just impacted me so completely.
I'm sure you've been on movies where you felt treated like shit as an extra or as a smaller part. And it's like, it just kills the whole fucking thing.
Yeah. Or an audition. I remember one, I think three actors have really been awful to me in auditions.
I feel like we're human, and I would love to just hear something that, I don't know, you know, if you're not comfortable, it's fair, but I don't know. I like this.
You know, I remember on Entourage, I auditioned for a part once and I got done. She's like, "Eric, that was the best audition we had." I'm like, "Amazing. Holy shit." And it was playing an agent, which I never get to play. It takes work, friend, for me to play these blue collar parts. Like, I played a janitor. Dad, I was a CBS dad in this pilot last year, and I had to like Google mop tutorials because I got fired. I got a pizza place shut down by the health department because I wasn't good at mopping. And then I saw the script had me mopping, and I'm like, "Holy shit, I got fired for this 20 years ago. Let me look at this." So it's kind of a challenge at times.
Are you comfortable sharing a story?
No, go ahead.
Being fired.
Oh yeah.
That's what I want to hear, and then I won't push.
No. I've got all these, and I love this. I think the real growth comes from failure.
When I interviewed Paul Williams, when you can check it out, he talks about the power of no, and what he means is no is a gift. When something's not meant for you, don't look at it as like, oh, I don't have that. Look at that as like that. That's a gift. It puts you on another direction that wouldn't have been good. So if you know, I want to hear that.
You know what they call him, right? His nickname in Hollywood?
No.
The Pauly Llama.
Really?
Because he's helped so many people.
He's reached out to me in ways that he never had to, and he's been very kind to me. Generosity like that that I've gotten has changed my life forever.
Yeah, and like he's dragged people to sobriety.
Are you a musical fan? And if so, are you a fan of Phantom of the Paradise?
I knew you were asking. My friends, I don't know if you know the rock band Tegan and Sarah, but they're obsessed with that movie, and I'm really good friends with Tegan, and they go to a screening, and so I really, one of my big goals is to introduce Tegan to Paul Williams, and I have this idea of a scene for all of us. I've wanted Paul Williams to play my dad forever, of like me not knowing that he's not my biological dad, that I've never figured it out, and Tegan to play my friend. So I have this huge dream of Paul Williams playing it. But yeah, my friend Tegan is obsessed with that movie, and I need to see it because I've not seen it yet.
It's the kind of movie, it's a hard watch, but you have to watch it 5-6 times and then you'll fucking love it forever.
I'm in. That's some of my favorite movies are like that. A lot of art, you gotta work for it, you know? But the reward is there.
I love movies, and there's certain, I don't always love slow movies, but there's certain movies I've seen that are slow as fuck, and you're artsy movies, and you're watching, you're like, if I'm in here another 5 minutes, I'm gonna kill myself. And then a little switch goes off and you're like, this is the best thing I've ever fucking seen, which feels like the closest I get to meditation.
Ah, amazing. I know, I dig it. It is. I mean, driving can be meditative.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways to do that. It's kind of the Lebowski effect. The first time I saw Big Lebowski, I was like, yeah, okay. Then the second time you see it, when you're not worried about the plot, it just unfolds on you and you just see these magical performances. And I also feel like if you've ever done a Sopranos rewatch, it's incredibly amazing, and you kind of realize it's one of the funniest shows ever. Once you're not worried about the plot, just kind of watch them, and you watch the King Gandolfini in his court. Oh, it's a gift.
Are there certain movies or TV shows that you always come back to that you've probably watched the most times?
Yeah, I mean, I think like probably a lot of people my age in the comedy world or whatever, I saw Ghostbusters and then wanted to act. I wanted to be Peter Venkman. I knew that was something amazing. And then, like I said earlier, Chris Farley. And then when I was in college, Rushmore came out. And to watch Bill Murray in Rushmore and to see how far he'd even come since Peter Venkman was shocking to me. And I'm like, God, just to be able to play a part like Herman Bloom one day. Another one I love for the performances is this weird Paul Schrader movie called Autofocus.
I love Autofocus. Tough movie to watch, but it's a great movie.
I mean, Willem Dafoe in that is one of the most hilarious performances of all time. It's hysterical.
It's the creepiest fuck role, and he nails it every
movie. It's just too perfect, but he's so willing to make himself be needy and uncool and desperate and gross. And that's what I love about character acting, and that was why I got disappointed in myself when I freaked out about having a small prosthetic dick and minx. But movies I buy that I just watch and put on for comfort, I love Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid by Peckinpah. And it is, you know, I know The Wild Bunch and everything. To me, it's just the most perfect Western, and like the relationship between Christofferson and James Coburn is amazing. And then you've got this bizarre performance by Bob Dylan. Peckinpah just put him in there with nudging from Christofferson. The studio did not want him in there.
I'm alias.
It's bizarre. It's wonderful. It's cool. And then I also love Masked and Anonymous, which is the Larry Charles Bob Dylan movie. And Bob Dylan plays Jack Fate, and it was widely panned by critics, but they are screening it this month. This podcast called Jokerman that celebrates late Bob Dylan and Bob Dylan on the road is screening it. And it was just kind of amazing to find out that there is this whole tribe of weirdos that also love Mastodon Anonymous. And then beyond that, I mostly watch YouTube concerts. I kind of have that on. So I watch Neil Young, I watch Dylan. You know, I love John Prine. Like, I get so inspired from that stuff. And during COVID, I would go back and rewatch. I hate people filming at concerts. I think it takes them out of it. I think it's the stupidest thing. I think you're missing the medicine. But I'm really grateful they do, because I go back and get to rewatch stuff. So I've been watching these Neil Young concerts, and that kind of sustained me during COVID.
Nice. All right. I want to mention one thing to you, because you talked about meditation. We just brought up James Coburn. If you get a chance, when James Coburn was on the Muppet Show, he does this sketch teaching Animal how to do meditation.
No, you're
kidding. Watch that, because I think you'd fucking love it.
Oh, I'm in. And you know, he's also on the cover of a Wings album.
James Coburn?
Swear to God. Look, there's a Wings album, and it's James Coburn cold chilling with Wings. No reason. They don't acknowledge, they don't say it, but it's incredible. His performance in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, boy, he really makes himself fucking evil. He really, like, and it's that whole thing that you kind of see in today's world of, like, at what cost is a human soul? At what cost are you willing to sell out a friend? And Chris has this great line where they're like, why are you talking to him? He's my friend. And he kind of expects the best out of his friend. And, you know, it's definitely the very opposite of what I've had in Hollywood, because I've met the greatest, most loyal friends. And that's why I'm sitting here with you today, if only because of Jake Johnson, or Jake, an autograph or something else.
What is the best story that's been told to you? And it could, you know, again, go anywhere you want. It could be weird, but
the best ones I can't tell, you know. There's literally one of, you know, next time I come to a Neil Young show in Philadelphia, I fell in love with Philadelphia and I was there, Slaughter Beach Dog. I'm seeing them in LA. When I was there, I was shocked by how friendly Philadelphians were. And it was the most, I had a perception perhaps from Philly sports fans booing Darren Dalton's kid, booing Santa Claus. They were the best Neil Young acoustic crowd I've ever heard. You could hear a pin drop. If somebody said anything, it was shh. And like, nobody would fuck with them because it's Philly. And then I kept running into the friendliest, nicest people. And that's also this magic thing about being a character actor. Because it's like Bob Odenkirk says, like, you know, the character actor is a slow boil. So Bob, like I said, I met Bob, he was on a downturn. So he got super famous at like 45 or 50. You're so grateful. And now when he's like, how can you not like somebody sees you and smiles? And it's like this world opens up. And I've gone to these with my friend Tom Kenny, who's the voice of SpongeBob. I've gone to Lucha Libre Wrestling, where we're the only folks there that are not Lucha Libre people. I've gone to underground jazz blues clubs with him, where it's the same deal. But this world opens up because he's SpongeBob and he does the voice. And when I go somewhere like Philadelphia, it's amazing to run into these people who see me and smile, and then magic things happen. And so, like I told you earlier, I went to Neil Young at the Tower Theater. And these sweet kids didn't want to bother me, but had a bet on whether I was really the guy from Drunk History and We Bear Bears or whatever. And then now I'm friends with this Philadelphia band called Slaughter Beach Dog, who steadily moved up the ranks. And now they're headlining the Ace Theater, and I'm friends with them.
What's the most memorable? What's one story that you think of like, oh man, I was so glad to hear that fucking story. And if you're willing to share it.
Okay, so the first really great one I have, and this is kind of the first one where I say, you know, that don't meet your heroes is total bullshit. I did a movie called Welcome to the Jungle years ago, and it starred Jean-Claude Van Damme. And I was a Van Damme guy as a kid. Like, you were either kind of Seagal or Van Damme. I was deeply Van Damme. And I show up, and he's doing his first comedy. And so the idea is Van Damme with comedy nerds, and hilarity will ensue. So it was like me, Kristen Shaw, Rob Hubel, Dennis Haysbert, Adam Brody, Megan Boone, Aaron Takahashi. I went to high school with Andrew Takahashi. And, you know, the critics would say hilarity did not ensue. But we did the best we could. We sure tried. But one day, I'm sitting there, and he's looking at me, and I used to have kind of a pronounced limp. I have arthritis from all the fun health stuff we were talking about earlier. He's like, let me ask you this. Why do you limp there? And I'm like, oh, I got arthritis in my knee. And, you know, I guess there's nothing you can really do. And blah, blah, blah. He's like, nah, there's everything you can do. If you believe you show up, then I'm going to work you out. You're going to need to strengthen all the muscles around your knee, and we get you better. And then you have no more limp. So I'm like, yeah. I mean, I'd love to. JC. We all called him JC. Like, that'd be incredible. But I don't think it's going to happen. Then one day, his assistant knocks at the door, Kathy, and says, JC would like to work you out today. And I'm like, oh my God, amazing. Now, this is a tiny budget movie. that is being shot for nothing. They got the money to shoot it after Van Damme said yes, because with Van Damme comes like, you know, $900,000 from whoever. And we are shooting in a timeshare in Puerto Rico. So it's half New Jersey tourists and half Van Damme and these comedy folks. And they can't believe they're on their timeshare and Van Damme is there. And there's no place else to work out. So he takes me to the gym of a timeshare. And then by the time, so we go to his place, he does a protein shake and then smokes two giant joints. Then he starts smoking cigarettes. And then he's like, I tell you one thing, everybody assume Van Damme want to work out. Van Damme, every day, I don't want to go to the gym, but I make myself. I don't want to go. Okay? If you don't want to go, you have to also know Van Damme don't want to go, but Van Damme go. Yeah. I'm like, yes, sir. And then we start getting in the gym and he starts like stretching me out. And then all the tourists start coming in, as is their right, in the timeshare gym. And they all start lifting shit. And they're lifting heavy shit and like going like this and acting like they're not doing it for Van Damme and acting like, you know, it's always the people that say they don't care about Hollywood that loves Hollywood the most. And they're throwing weights around. And then he looks at me and he's like, come here. And he picks up the little pink 2 pounders. And he's like, this is all you need with Van Damme. See? It's like you do meditation, Baba. Patience, flexibility, meditation. And then he just starts working me out in the gym with these 2 pound weights. But you lift them like 100 times and it hurts. But that's, he starts strengthening, showing me leg exercises to strengthen all the muscles around my knee. This dude is like a genius when it comes to the body. This is what he used to do. And his big dream was to open his own gym. And I think that's what he's doing around the time he got Predator, was like trying to open a gym. This guy, he got fired from Predator. He was the Predator and he had creative differences. And I think he was trying to do some improv and stuff. No, it's amazing. And so, son of a bitch, if this guy did not, I don't have a limp anymore. The stuff he did, I kept doing. I do leg stuff, and it's been a miracle for me. And it's all Jean-Claude Van Damme. And I have a million like that. And then my dog, you know, I always say you meet the, you know, best friends on some of the most challenging movies. And one day we were going back after shooting, and I got in the van, and Adam Brody and Megan Boone had a blanket, and underneath the blanket were these two puppies. Covered in mites, covered in ticks, like larva. And come here, Choopy. Come here. Come. And there she is. That's her. She's the nicest lady. They're called Satos. And they're Puerto Rican street dogs. Oh, and wow. So, you know, I brought back Choopy. My wife was cool with it. And she's the greatest dog that ever lived. And they're these magical creatures. And then I can always kind of look at her as like, well, this is a magical and amazing thing I got from acting. Better than an award. And then my other great story, when they say don't meet your heroes, clearly now you can tell I think that's bullshit because David Lynch is my hero. You know I love Neil Young. Well, I went to see him years ago in a show called, he did his show Greendale, which the crowd at the Greek Theater showed up and they thought they were getting the hits. And instead he played this rock opera he'd written that had not been released yet called Greendale. Now, I loved it. My buddy Scott Sayer, who I moved down with to Los Angeles, loved it. And then afterward, I think he drew the low straw. So I got to drink and party. And afterward, I want to go to In-N-Out Burger. I want to go to In-N-Out Burger. So we go there. We drive to In-N-Out Burger. And there is Neil Young's tour bus, which very famously has two skylights that look like little cars. And Scott's like, he's not in there. He probably sent a roadie in. We walk in there and there's Neil Young. And he's the only guy more stoned than I am. And he's looking around at like paintings and I was like, huh? And then he's like, animal style? What's animal style? And then I just blurt out, I go, oh! And then Neil Young turns and sees this giant guy, and I was much bigger back then even. Giant guy in a Greendale shirt. And he goes, ha! And he starts like laughing. And then we walk up and start telling him the right thing, which was how much we loved Greendale. And he could tell we loved Greendale. Like, and then the thing with Sun Green and Jeb and Carmichael, like, why'd he shoot him? Oh, man. And he loved it. And then his road manager comes. He's like, guys, let's take this outside. And I'm like, oh, he's going to tase me or get us away. And then Neil Young walks outside, In-N-Out Burger with us. The tour manager goes, let's get a picture.
Oh, my God.
Takes a picture and then sends us on our way. And the picture, the three of us are just giddy and happy. And, you know, I'm going to see Neil Young tonight and everything's full circle and he's at the Greek Theater and more people will boo because they're not getting the hits. But for somebody like me that's a huge fan, it's the greatest thing ever.
I want to end this interview asking, and this is kind of a traditional question, but I really want you to dig and think about it. Where do you see yourself in 25 years?
Yeah, I mean, my goal is always to be happy, healthy, and at work. And so what I want to do is to stay strong and get stronger every day. So when I hit that age, I'm ready to keep going. Because based on a character actor trajectory at 71, I'm hopefully working more than I ever have. And I'm hoping, as I see myself right now, keep getting better. My great acting teacher, I told you about, David Avkali, had a great run, sadly passed away 2 years ago. So now I'm trying to find a new Yoda to help me. But yeah, I definitely want to be, you know, able to just pick and choose the projects I love and to do movies I love, and more than anything, work with my friends. So if you're telling me right now that in, you know, 25 years, I'm doing another TV show with Jake Johnson, then to me, that's a dream and that's a life well lived.
And how old would you be at that point? You'd be like
71. And we're already old men at heart anyway. So, you know, it's really fun. You can watch This Is My Friend on Vimeo if you want to see baby Jake and baby Eric. It's called This Is My Friend. And yeah, I'm hoping that I'm in 25 years working with Jake Johnson and my wife. And you know what? Hopefully Neil Young too. And Tegan Quinn. And then I'll be just golden.
Thank you so much for listening. I'm going to keep it very brief and simple. We are about to have our year anniversary for the podcast, which is, I think, around September 23rd. We're going to be doing an event, a live Zoom, as a memorial to Paul Rubens, P.B. Herman. I got very lucky to get friendly with Paul. He was a follower of our page, and he was very kind to me, and I just want to really honor him. So if you know, we're asking people for stories, you know, creative. I mean, someone sent a puppet show, creative things. We're trying to find, you know, mix it up from fans, the people that might have worked with him or have known him, or anyone who was really touched by his life or influence. And I'm asking people to send a video. If you don't want to be on the video, you can just put some images on there. It's just easier to do it in video form. So that's about it. And again, we got a few more episodes for this season. We'll be probably taking a week break, and then we got another 52 episodes for season two. I really have to give a big thank you to everyone who really helped me get here. This is definitely a group effort. I've gotten really lucky to get a lot of guests who are, you know, in my opinion, are way above my pay grade, way out of my league. One of the people who's been really helpful to me is Otter Castro, he was basically a huge fan. He's listened to every episode, and I've made the episodes, but I haven't listened to them all after. It's sometimes just too hard to even get them done. But he's just a fan. He's really, you know, he's been a researcher. He knows about a lot of the stuff we post. He's a very just good human being, hard worker, and very smart. And he's been our main editor. At some point, we are looking for another editor to come in. That being said, you know, I don't get to pay a lot because I don't make money at this, but there's some money that comes in that gets shared with people that are involved. It's not something to do for money, but, you know, I will take care of you, Grant, you know, when money comes in. And I do throw out tips for that kind of work. So we are looking for another editor, anyone who's a big fan of the page who really gets it. Preferably we're looking for someone, more people of color, people that are queer, because I'm just trying to really, you know, 33% of the page's posts and all the episodes are inclusive of people of color, minority, you know, all kinds, you know, queer voices. And I really want to bring that into the whole process. We're also looking for people to co-host or even host their own episodes at a certain point. So reach out. Our website is vintageannosarchive.com. You can email me at vintageannosarchive@gmail.com if you'd like to get involved. And again, thank you so much. We got a few, you know, so many great things coming up. If you go to our webpage, there's a podcast page, and it has a lot of our future lineup and our past lineup. And I don't know. I mean, I don't, you know, this has been a crazy and amazing ride. But again, this is our 49th episode. I was so busy doing this that I feel like it's a blur. And all of a sudden, like, I woke up out of a blur, and there's like, oh, here's 50, here's 49 episodes. At a certain point, before the last few months, it was just me doing all this. And Otter is a godsend. But, you know, each episode would take about 30 hours total with editing and researching and interviewing. And I'm really glad to have him because I could not keep going at that rate. It's why I, you know, I referenced in the earlier part about not always being the best listener, but exhaustion adds to that. Anyway, enjoy. Take care. Until next time. Bye-bye. We thought indifferent.